It's Thursday, March 15th, 07, and I'm very, very pleased to see so many here today, and want to invite Dr. Nichol up with us as I continue my conversation with you. And I understand that we have a lot of stakeholders here with us today, and you're going to be talking to the choir, people who believe as you believe. So I want you to be comfortable, not be nervous, not to be intimidated, but when you speak from the heart, it's about something that we all care about and want to make a difference in. So I'm just saying that as a means of any of you who are not used to coming before a legislative panel, senators on this side, House members on that side. House members have gone back into session. That's why they are not here at this moment. So you might see some coming and going, and it's because they're being called from time to time to the floor. But welcome to your Senate today, and the discussion is all about House Bill 5031, which is the Department of Human Services Addictions and Mental Health Division. Dr. Nichol will start off with us. Thank you very much, and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nichol, and I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. It's a pleasure to be here, and appreciate the opportunity to give an overview first this afternoon about the mission and some of the goals of the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I want to give a quick overview of the budget, and then as quickly as I can, I'd really like for the committee to have a chance to hear the people who have come to talk about their stories briefly and allow some questions. I'm hopeful that today we can get through the addictions prevention section and maybe into alcohol and drug treatment, but we'll see how that goes as always. I'm going to just reference things in the booklet that you have, and I'll start on page 3 of 74, and I will not read this all, so I'm going to hit the highlights. I just want to talk out loud once about the mission of the Addictions and Mental Health Division is to prevent and reduce the negative effects of alcohol, other drugs, gambling addiction, and mental health disorders, and I think more importantly, promote recovery through culturally competent, integrated, evidence-based treatments for addictions, including pathological gambling, mental illness, and emotional disorders. I would like to also to say something that's not in the booklet, but that this is really all about, as Dr. Dean Brooks has shared with me. Dr. Brooks, as you probably remember, was the superintendent and kind of the mental health institution in Oregon from 1955 to 1982. And I asked him one time what his biggest challenge was. And it was, as he called it, the campaign against dehumanization. What we're working on now is the same campaign, hopefully in a new edition of it, but we're really working on the idea that people with these kinds of disorders are first and foremost citizens, human beings, incapable of recovery. It's not about just managing their illness, and it's not about only protecting public safety. Those things will take care of themselves if we do a good job of being recovery-focused. I'm pleased that there are so many people in this state who are finding ways, many pathways to recovery from both mental illnesses and alcohol and drug problems. So a few of the goals are listed on page 3. I'll just highlight a couple of them. I think we're very focused this particular session on the number of children coming into and remaining in the child welfare system. So one of our goals is to reduce that number and to reduce the number of placements kids have by providing better and more effective and focused treatment to the parents whose substance abuse, often methamphetamine, is really driving the increase in child welfare issues.
This morning I was speaking with the co-chairs, and something that both you and I care about that is going to be coming soon. And one of the concerns of the co-chairs is that we don't have enough performance measures around any actions that we take, and also that we don't measure outcomes well. I'm saying this to you, but I'm saying it to everybody that is here, that as you do your work, that it's very, very important that we can show the state that we can measure to a degree. Because it's not a science like having you know, being in an institutional setting where you have 500 people and they go to so many group treatments or individual treatments, and you can see the outcomes like that. But some kind of way we've got to do a great job with performance measures and then performance outcomes, and show them what we're buying, show the state what we're buying with the money that they're being given. Can you address that, please?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's something that I think we have not done as good a job as we can do. You'll see through our presentation a real emphasis on that. And I welcome any questions about outcomes. I'm going to present to you a little later in the presentation. I won't get into it in detail now. A way that we have a thinking about it, I probably have been watching too much Kansas basketball on TV, and I'll admit to that. But the truck commercials have intrigued me, not because I particularly like trucks, but they show the exterior of a truck, and they show the inner workings of the truck, and then they show the cab. The cab is very comfortable. To me, that speaks to the issues of client satisfaction, because if people aren't comfortable being with us, they're not going to go along for the ride. What you all look at, I think, importantly, is what does the outside of this thing look like, and is it getting real outcomes? We in the system have to look at some of the internal measures. Is the electrical system working? How many people are we serving? All of those things are very important, but what we need to do a better job, I think, with you about is talking about the real outcomes, like reducing child welfare expenditures, decreasing health expenditures, increasing employment, etc., etc. And I will try throughout my presentation to walk through those things. I do think it's something that we can measure. Sometimes what we do doesn't directly affect the employment rate, but it should indirectly affect it for the better, for example. And I think we need to be willing to talk about those things and be more accountable for those things.
Thank you.
I think rather than read through the whole list of goals, they're pretty self-evident, and I'll skip over. I'm not going to say a lot about the history on page 4 of your booklet. One important thing to note again is that in 2001, the addictions systems were integrated again into a state office, and I really don't like to think about it as integrating mental health into addictions or addictions into mental health. So many people that we serve have both sets of problems. And I'm also fond of saying, let's keep addiction separate where it should be separate. Let's keep mental health where it should be separated. But let's where they need to be combined, let's have the courage to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think there are ways that we can do that.
Bob, you did skip over the history, but there's one point in here that I think is extremely important, and that's the evidence-based practices that came in 2003. I guess I have not heard that before, and we don't have to address it now, but as we go along, that seems to me, if we're doing performance measures, they're based on evidence-based practices, and that should go hand in hand.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said that exactly. I think evidence-based practice is in some ways a process kind of measurement. But if we do evidence-based practices, we'll get the kind of outcomes that Senate Bill 267 asked for us to get to. And those were things like reducing the use of psychiatric emergency care and decreasing criminal justice involvement and juvenile justice involvement. I will point out, and I did want to highlight this since I'm going to talk primarily about addictions issues today, that during 2005-2007, the goal under Senate Bill 267 was to demonstrate that 50% of the services offered by funding are evidence-based, and we have a more detailed report on this, but we were able to show that 56% of addiction services already in this biennium are evidence-based. So we exceeded, actually we only need to be at 25% for 2005. We've already shown that we're where we needed to be for the coming biennium, and our goal, of course, will be to get to 75%, and I think that's a challenge. It's very difficult to do without additional resources, but I think everybody in the field has been doing a heroic job of understanding what the evidence-based practices are. We've listed 150 of them plus on our website. We've gone through a process with everybody to get to that. And I think the field, particularly addictions, has done very well in demonstrating that. I'm going to jump to the color chart on page 5. And the numbers are pretty clearly outlined there. $766.2 million is in the governor's recommended budget. That's total funds. Other pie charts later on show the breakdown in general fund and other funds and federal funds. I do want to point out, this is very important, that the Oregon Health Plan budget, which is under DMAP, actually has a total of $430.7 million in addition to what you see here for mental health and addiction services. The breakdown on that just quickly is $390 million for mental health and about $40 million for alcohol and drug services. These are services offered either through fully capitated health plans for chemical dependency benefits or the mental health organizations, which are the mental health Medicaid managed care organizations. So as you can see, the Oregon Health Plan dollars are more than half of, are over half of what the community budget is. There are several other ways of displaying the same information on page 6. There's a bar chart that shows you in comparison a little bit more easily the breakdown in total funds by funding source. Alcohol and drug prevention, which we'll talk about more today, as you can see, is except for staffing for three state-operated facilities, which we proposed in mental health, is the smallest funding that we have. It's even less than what I think is a pretty small amount of money for administering the system. So I think that'll be a theme that we'll probably talk a little bit more as we go along about. Roughly, the addictions budget is about one-sixth of the mental health budget, and that's been a fairly constant figure for a while. Although, the other thing that I want to point out just in a quick overview here is that we're not really back to where we were with alcohol and drug funding before the loss of the Oregon Health Plan and before the fiscal crises of 2002 and 2003 led to other general fund cuts in residential care and outpatient care. So we're proposing, and the governor's recommended budget, additional funds, but I want to be clear that it does not get us back to where we were before.
Even with the proposal that you have today? Not today.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
The only other thing that I want to say in overview before we go on is to have the panelists that between mental health and addictions, we're serving about 173,000 Oregonians a year. That doesn't count the universal prevention, which we think reaches at least 800,000 Oregonians. But we serve a significant share of the Oregon population. Mental health and addictions issues are very common, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into detail. The public funds are not the only funding available for mental health and addictions statewide, but they are a big portion of it. With parity being implemented and the Senate Bill 1 being passed last time, I think it's too early to know exactly what kind of effect that's going to have, but that should increase the non-public funded alcohol and other mental health services. I think I'll pause here and see if there are any questions, and then I would propose we ask the people who have volunteered to come and talk to you to come.
Any questions of Dr. Nicol? Thank you. So we want to start calling our panel up, and what I will do is call you two at a time so that I think you'll be a little comfortable to each other. Christine Stolbarger, Heather McCann Schneider. Introduce yourselves, and I know you see the faces up here who are very welcoming, including Dr. Bates and Senator Morissette, who have joined us after I told you that you can feel comfortable about coming up. Don't be nervous or be afraid. All these people up here who are supporters. So you can determine who's going to start first.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christine Stolbarger, and I'm a recovering addict. First, I want to start by telling you a little about what it was like when I was actively using drugs. I started smoking marijuana and binge drinking when I was around 13 years old. And it escalated, and I used for 31 years. I eventually got help, and because of my addiction, I didn't go to college. I barely graduated from high school. I worked a lot of minimum wage jobs, barely kept those. I had no self-esteem, no life goals. Most of the time I spent on welfare and food stamps and every other government program. I had a series of very abusive relationships, a lot of DV relationships, and eventually I was pretty much ripe for using meth. I ended up using meth and used that for 9 years. My meth use, of course, escalated my addiction. I started being involved in criminal activity. I had an open DHS case of 3 children. I wish I could tell you that the first time I went to treatment, it worked, and I stayed clean, but I didn't. You see, I had a lot of trauma and abuse in my life, and drugs were the coping mechanism that I used to deal with my life. So once the drugs were removed, I didn't have anything to cope with, and there was a lot of dysfunction that I had to look at. I needed not only CD treatment, but I also needed some mental health counseling to deal with my life and to eventually be able to live clean and sober. Luckily, I received both eventually. And what my life has been like since I've been in recovery has been totally great. I've been clean and sober for over 4 years. I've been off welfare, which has probably saved the government at least $20,000 just in cash amounts, not in food stamps, Oregon Health Plan, and everything else. I'm a student in the alcohol and drug program at PCC, and I'll graduate this summer with an associate's degree and take the CADC test in September. I'll then be a certified drug and alcohol counselor, and I have plans to go to PSU next fall and get my bachelor's degree. I'm 48, so it was a little late starting, but, you know, I'm going to get there. I've stayed employed and paying taxes. I mentor women who have drug and alcohol issues and are involved with the child welfare system through Parents Anonymous. I have a unique understanding because of where I've been to help these women reach recovery. Many of the women that I mentor have had their children returned and their cases closed. I'm able to parent my 3 children and my 1 grandchild. My kids are 26, 22, and 13. I'm actively involved in my youngest son's middle school and in the parent group. It's important that I break the cycle of addiction in my family and that I'm a role model, you know, for my grandson's never ever seen me clean, you know, anything but what I am now, the clean and sober grandparent that he knows. My children go to NA meetings with me. We take a yearly, we go to a Narcotics Anonymous camp out every summer. So my kids are growing up in seeing recovery. This has stopped them from using drugs, I believe. And I drive legally with insurance, not something I ever did when I was in my addiction. And all of this has been possible because I was allowed to go to treatment. And I want you to understand that we do recover, but we need help. And we need help by not having to pay for treatment, because I truly would not have went if it was a money issue, because I didn't have the skills to even, you know, support myself, let alone pay for me to go to treatment. So what I'd like from you is to please fund the governor's budget, don't cut addictions and mental health dollars, and find a way to give me even more to the budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heather Schneider. I'm a College Dreams graduate in Alcohol and Drug Prevention Program in Josephine County. Here is my story and my request for your consideration. I grew up in Wolf Creek, an area known for drug raids and criminals. I lived in a small shack with no rain water. We used an outhouse even during the winter. Our house had black plastic where the fourth wall should have been. There were piles of clothes, trash, and dog feces everywhere. I'm the youngest of 6 children, all having different fathers. My mother was known as a druggie who had many live-in-dope boyfriends. I often lived with my mom's friends because she was in and out of jail so often. When mom was home, she was usually doing drugs or busy with her boyfriend. Sometimes she tried to be a good mom. She made us go to school because that meant we got two free meals. I was physically abused when my mom was high on drugs, especially by her boyfriend. I often had bruises or black eyes and was questioned at school, but I decided to lie to protect my family. The abuse didn't stop there. I wanted a better life, but I knew no outsiders who had gone to college or were successful. I dreamed of being a doctor or a lawyer, but that seemed impossible. Just before sixth grade, I was invited to join College Dreams. I was surprised anyone wanted me to be a part of something that had to do something with college. Now I had hope. Now I knew people who wore nice clothes and who were college graduates. This was very foreign to me. They told me they believed in me and that I could be anyone I wanted to be. I just gave them dirty looks and said whatever. By the end of sixth grade, living conditions at home got even worse and made it impossible for me to stay. I was becoming a teenager and needed to shower every day, which was impossible with no running water. Other middle school students were brutal towards dirty kids and I was so sensitive. So we moved into a trailer on a friend's property with my mom's boyfriend. That year, mom became very sick. Her medical conditions were life-threatening, and she became too weak to take care of herself. She had exploratory surgery and was diagnosed with gastric cancer. She passed away only weeks later. Now I was down to no parents. My older sister was granted custody of me. Unfortunately, she had young children and was addicted to drugs. She started drinking every night. She was often too hungover to take me to soccer games or would forget to pick me up from practice. I decided to move in with a close family friend, and life was great. I wasn't exposed to drugs, sex, or alcohol, and school was going fine. I was clean and had what I needed. That's when I decided to act out. I couldn't handle the fact that mom was dead and my brothers and sisters didn't care. When I tried to run away, the cops were called, and I was taken to juvenile shelter. I hated that place. My sister failed to show up in court, signed away her rights, and I became a foster child. I thought my life was over. College Dreams program directors were very active in my life and helped me through all the challenges I was facing. They made sure that I had what I needed and that I continued to do well in school. I bounced from foster home to foster home until I settled with my family. After 2 years, I was determined to be in control of my own life, so I moved out. Now I was in my own apartment, working full-time, and trying to graduate from high school. It was too much. I dropped out of school, went back for a second try, and was kicked out. Once again, I thought my life was over. However, College Dreams wouldn't stop believing me, and since sixth grade, I had earned enough scholarship money for 2 terms of college. I moved to Bremerton, Washington with my husband, who was in the Navy. With his support, I enrolled at Olympic College and completed my high school diploma. I am the first high school graduate in my family. Last summer, I was hired as a College Dreams junior counselor to work with the first Fostering Success children. These kids in summer camp all live in foster homes, which I understand all too well. I just love those kids and will continue to help them any way I can. Working with College Dreams and Fostering Success lit a passion in me. I have decided that my career will be spent making life better for all kids who end up in foster care. I am finishing my fifth college term with a 3.75 GPA. I love sociology and psychology, and I am excited about my future. I learned how to build my own healthy family from the people who helped me get to where I am. I am proud I made it and will only continue to excel. I can't imagine anything more challenging than my childhood and teen years. I'm determined to live life right and achieve my every dream. Since sixth grade, College Dreams showed me that graduation was possible and that college could become a reality for me. I was sure my life would be filled with alcohol, drugs, welfare, but instead, I am the first in my family to even attend a college. I had prevention in my life. I saw what drugs and alcohol had done to my mom, my brothers, and my sister. They paid the price in tragic ways and continue to suffer today. I think about how I grew up in foster care and how College Dreams was always there for me, giving me hope and something to look forward to. I still got in trouble and made mistakes, but they never gave up. They showed me the right path and how to get focused again. Prevention is key when you are surrounded by nothing but things you should avoid in your life. Thank God I had this amazing chance to become a success and help younger children. Prevention is making a huge difference for more than 400 College Dreamers in Josephine County. Please support the proposed budget for substance abuse prevention and treatment to help prevention programs like College Dreams continue to help the most vulnerable children and give them the dream to live as I am now truly living mine. Thank you, and it is my honor to be here and share my story.
Thank you. You did a good job. And thank you so very much for your testimony today.
Are you? Just some moral support.
Moral support. Oh, that's good. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Bates, excuse me.
Sure, if I might.
Oh, okay. We're a little late, but come on back.
Okay.
Dr. Bates, and then Ms. I just so much want to tell you how much your stories mean to us. And I think that all of us are overwhelmed by the strength that you found inside of yourselves to walk the paths that you've walked. And I just want you to know that we wish you the greatest success. We have huge hope for you and for what you have found, the strength and the purpose that you found in your lives. And it really makes what we do worthwhile when we get the opportunity to meet people like you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm a physician and also a state senator, and I find your stories incredibly inspiring. Many of us were born on first, second, or third base and think we hit doubles and triples and home runs. You guys never had to swing at the ball until the home run. And it's really an amazing story from both of you. Heather, I'd like to ask you something if I could. I don't mean to embarrass you either, but thinking of what you went through and all the programs that were there for you in one shape or another, what would you have changed going through that? That we could have done more to help you during all those years that you suffered. What could we have done that would have been more effective to help you? You were just a child, no choice of where you were at, and trying to get through a very difficult situation. What could we as legislators have done differently? What programs could we have brought you? What could we have done differently that would have helped you more? Do you know?
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, I think that healthy adult involvement in children that don't have prevention, I think that it's needed in schools. I went to Wolf Creek Elementary, which was, I think I had 15 kids in my class, and there were 6 teachers, a principal, and 2 office aides. But I think that just having people that know prevention and know what you're going through, that teachers are close to you, but I think that just having that healthy adult involvement, I think it's more needed. And I think that that's really what changed my life, was that was the first healthy adult besides the teacher that I had had in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's more needed. And I could have helped if I had it before 6th grade in elementary school, which I never had.
Hello, Madam Chair.
You may.
So what I think I'm hearing here is that a school-based program was the one that gave you the most hope and help. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. I would say, yeah.
And if it started earlier, it might have been more helpful to you?
I think that obviously it helped me. I'm a success story. I just think that obviously money is needed for them to stay involved, and I think that more adults could be more involved if more money was there. And I think I'm very thankful for College Students and everything they could do for me. I just think that more could be done if resources were there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Marsha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you pulled yourself back from the brink, but you may not have been able to without help from other people, right? And programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Marsha, I think, are you asking me towards like drugs and alcohol side of it, or?
Well, I guess I'm making an observation of how much of this you did all by yourself and how much of it you did because there are other people there to help you. Now, I don't want to diminish what you were able to do because you, I think, exemplify a lot of courage and stick-to-itiveness, but if you didn't have the support groups that you had, and I guess that's what I'm getting at, is people who don't have the support groups and who have the potential, what happens to people who have potential and no support groups? That's my question.
I had the hope and the dream of being different, but going from losing my mom to going into another addict's home, which was my family, I started to slip. When I was only 13, they tried to get me to do meth. They did lines in front of me. They offered me alcohol. And it was College Dreams. When you sign up, you sign a contract saying that you won't do drugs and alcohol. And I was so terrified of losing them that I didn't even try it. Until I was in high school, I did drink, but I never tried any drugs. I did get in trouble for marijuana, but it was nothing. I wasn't involved, and I wasn't smoking, and my UAs were always clean. So I went through the same road, but College Dreams pulled me out. They gave me hope. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. So I guess what I hear what you're saying is that your success depended a lot on the fact that you had a very, very important support group there for you that had confidence in you, that gave you confidence in yourself and helped you to change your life, right?
I think completely 100%. I think that if they weren't there to pick me up from the juvenile department and they didn't show up to my CRBs while I was going through foster care, I had no hope. I wanted to be just like my sister and my mom. I didn't know any different besides what College Dreams taught me.
One other quick observation. I think that we have a responsibility to help the support groups. Some of them are nonprofit. Some of them are state agencies, county agencies, and our obligation is to make sure the support groups are there for people who do have that desire, like you. So that's our obligation. Thank you.
Representative Pro Tem?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Heather and Christine, for being here, and congratulations on your sobriety. Question for Christine. We're currently working at what we can do to improve our TANF program, our cash welfare program. And I was just wondering, where along your timeline, it seems you're connected with welfare, also lost your kids. Wondering what point would have been helpful for you. We're trying to make sure that the program, when someone comes in the door in crisis, that we're assessing what they need so we can help them before they lose their kids. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on what happened to you and what we could do better.
That's a great, great question.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I forgot how I was supposed to do this, but I think what would have helped is what I see, and with women that I work with, that they have absolutely no skills at all. No skills. That other than something that's going to get them a minimum wage job. So allowing them maybe to get TANF and go into a short-term training program. You know, I understand that that's hard for long-term if they're going to go back to college. But something short-term that's going to get them off welfare, you know, because, you know, a lot of times people think that people enjoy getting a state check or that they like using food stamps. And it takes your self-esteem away to use that Oregon Trail card. So being able to actually pay cash, you know, and make above, you know, what a welfare check is a big deal. And when I finally got clean and sober, that's one of the things I thought, I don't want to be on welfare anymore. What am I going to have to do to get off of welfare? And it was, I have to go back to school. I was 45 years old, and it was like, I'm too old to go to school. But I had counselors, and I had mental health therapists that believed in me, that said, you're not too old, and you can do this. Sorry.
Yes, sorry.
This will finish right there.
And they were right.
And they were. And, you know, and I'm in the Honor Society, and I've been a 4-point student most of the time. And, though my older two haven't went to college, they, you know, they're contemplating it, you know, and they're believing that it's possible because I did it, you know, and I'm helping them do their FAFSA, and my youngest son wants to go to college, and he knows that if he doesn't go to college, he's not going to make enough money to support himself, you know, and I never thought I could do any better than welfare. You know, I thought I would be on welfare my whole life, and then after that I'd be on Social Security, and that was it.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
I'm just going to say, Christine, usually we're bringing that, you know, box of tissue up here because Chair Carter and I are crying. So, you know, that's the way it is. So.
Chair Carter, thank you for your indulgence on this, because I think that this is really what we're trying to get to here is the central issue around recovery. And there are many paths. And I think that there are as many paths as there are people that come to the place that you have come to. And that there are hands that are out there to hold you and help you. But if you don't let that, if you don't find that place inside of you where you're ready to go there, it doesn't. You become a casualty in the program. You become, you know, someone that comes around and does it again. But it is so magical to see the place where people find inside themselves the energy to step out and be the person that is inside, secretly inside of themselves. And that's the part I think that we're really appreciative of.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Lee.
And I apologize for being late. We just got finished with our floor session.
Okay.
But I wanted to say I'd be remiss. I have the wife of our community college president in the room, and I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that my dream is at some point, if we can ever get our legislative process scheduled so I can return to school and get my master's degree in literature, because I have a book I want to write or finish. It's written. But I need to have that, I think, for myself, because I want that. I don't know why I want those letters behind my name. And I admire you for doing what you've done, and you're setting a great example for your kids. And I've worked in a lot of different areas of human services, and one of them was a welfare to work program that was really small, and really, it was through Clatsop Community College. But I hear from some of the graduates of that program occasionally, and they've gone on to do great things. And some of them have gone on to finish, you know, their four-year degree and advanced degrees, or they started businesses. But they started down that little hill, and they slid to the bottom and got their momentum up, and they did what they wanted to do. And like Representative Morgan said, they found that little self inside themselves, and that's who they really were. So way to go.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for being with us today. I told you find waterheads up here too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like Ms. Danielle Gordney and Olivia Ojovia Pineda.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Bates.
While these people are coming up, you know, this Heather's case is especially touching to me because it illustrates one of my biggest frustrations, concerns. We have all these multiple overlapping programs that can't quite be brought together. CAF, the Commission, Drug and Alcohol Treatment. And most of the time, they're not even the schools where the kids need them the most.
Right.
You know, there's all these silos we have. And I know some of the schools are moving forward with programs to bring social services into the schools, which needs to be done, but it's still siloed off. And here's a young woman living at best like a third world country,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of resources, but none ever brought to bear for her until she was a teenager.
Yeah. And Christine was
aren't coordinated.
Yeah. Christine was a 13-year-old too, and it just tells us about the need for school-based clinics where these kids can have identity with the teachers and the staff at schools that will help them to identify some issues that they probably would never tell someone in general society because they don't want their parents in trouble. And it just tells us why these things are so important. Welcome. Who wants to go first? Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Danielle Zagorodny, and I'm a drug court graduate. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to let you in on my story. At 14, I began smoking pot, drinking, and some LSD. By the end of that summer, I was locked up in an inpatient treatment facility. Thus began my cycle. Instead of learning how to stop it, I learned only how to perpetuate it. I ended up in four inpatient treatment facilities, length of stay anywhere from 2 weeks to 14 months, for a total of 2.5 years by the time I was 17. I learned quite a bit in each of them. I learned how I was supposed to think, that something was broken in me, and that I wasn't able to think that way. And mostly I learned what to say and how to act to make them think I was all better. I began using meth at 17, for about 9 months, and then I met a boy. I was 17, he told me I was pretty, and he didn't do drugs. I had found a way out. I stopped using for 5 years. After my divorce, October of 2003, I began drinking. It was like I had never stopped. My gums would bleed, my hair was falling out. I was irresponsible with my money, my safety, and my body. I was a mother at this point, and a good one until I began to drink. I would sober up just long enough to visit her, but as that became more increasingly difficult, the visits became fewer and far between. I couldn't let her see what I had become. I found meth again in May of 2004 to try and quit drinking, and it worked, and I was sure that I could quit again. Within 2 months, I had lost my job, my apartment turned into a dope house, and I rarely saw my baby girl. I began a string of crimes since I had no money and no hope. Not to say that I had no other choice, but only that my mind was so deluded that I didn't see what was so obvious to friends and family. I began racking up charges faster than the courts could sentence me on them. In 9 of 04, I had a DCS-2, PCS-2, theft one by receiving. 12 of 04, PCS-2. 4/27 of 05, PV, PCS-2, theft one, theft two times three. And 2 days later, ID theft. Finally, at sentencing in 5/31 of 07, I knew everything was about to change. I had come to what's known in my circles as a jumping off point. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. This was the first day of the rest of my life. I knew if I went to prison, I would never stop. I could give up on any dreams of being a mother to a wonderful child. I had dug myself too deep. My lawyer had nothing encouraging to say, and the judge was not willing to delay on sentencing any longer. He had begun to explain my sentence of 24 months, no good time, no AIP. He had told me that it was a shame I couldn't have turned it around. He mentioned drug court, but as a closed option, since they had no additional funds, and I had no insurance, and I certainly couldn't afford $200 a month in treatment costs. I begged him to call my mother, and perhaps she would pay for it. I knew in my heart that he wouldn't. I was scum. I was filth. I was broken. There was no need to waste their time. But to my surprise, he did. I was blessed to not have burned the bridge with my mother too badly. I was blessed to get that 12th final chance. I was blessed so many ways that day and every day thereafter. The program was rough for me. Given my past treatment, it was very clear that I would be a tough nut to crack. I entered drug court not wanting to live the way I had been living. I naturally began to find a way to get high and and not lose everything. My goal was to stay clean for 1 year. Surely then I could figure out where I had gone wrong. I knew that drug court knew everything. The drug court team had a real omnipotence about them. So to avoid being caught in any lies, I tried this new thing called honesty. Surprisingly, it worked. Drug court also pushed me into trying other concepts once alien to me. Accountability, self-respect, punctuality, persistence, acceptance, and trust. One by one, these concepts fell into place, and I could use them in my everyday life, something I'd never been able to do in inpatient treatment. Something changed in me. I finally realized that the system was actually there to help me, that there was a better way to live. Drugs, crimes, and misery didn't have to be a part of my life. I finally got it. I wasn't destined for suffering. Today, I am 614 days clean, 14 hours and 53 minutes. A mother, a daughter, a friend, a graduate of Straight Facts, the rent program, parenting classes. I've held a job for over 18 months. I pay and file my taxes. I'm a straight-A student, full-time at Chemeketa. I am an active participant of the recovery community, a volunteer for No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood, and I do my best to always give back to the community that I harmed. All of this because I was given a chance to become a drug court participant. The drug court team, God, and the fellowship of other addicts and alcoholics inspired me to become who I am today. And today I'm grateful to be a drug court graduate and alumni. For this much gratitude to come from so much turmoil, it would be a great shame for anyone to miss this opportunity. I'm not asking that you fund this program out of compassion, but out of hope, because it works. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Olivia Pineda, and I am a certified alcohol and drug counselor from Madras, Oregon, in Jefferson County. I currently work for Programa Recuperación de Madras, a residential and outpatient treatment center. Programa Recuperación de Madras is under the umbrella of Best Care Treatment Services. Jefferson County is the most diverse county in the state. We like to say that Jefferson County is one-third Latino, one-third Native American, and one-third cowboy. And we're still trying to implement an outreach program. So if you have any ideas, please let me know. And these are some of the reasons why. When we consider the needs of our communities, we must consider the needs of all the diverse cultural and ethnic communities of Oregon. These include African American, Latinos, Native American, Russian. Culturally specific programs are an investment in effective services for people who have roots or are making the roots here in Oregon. The people these programs serve return to our communities to get jobs, send their children to school, and pay taxes. They contribute to the richness of all of our lives. To be most effective, treatment needs to be delivered in a cultural context that is meaningful to the client. Culturally specific programs have been historically been underfunded here in Oregon and are particularly stressed due to the rapidly growing Latino population in Oregon and the serious difficulties the programs have in finding qualified clinicians. I would like to share to you a story and the fruits of an investment that happened over 20 years ago. My father, just like a lot of immigrants, came to the United States when I was 4 years old, which it isn't very long. My father went through a lot. Both my parents went through a lot. He was an alcoholic for a lot of years, a lot of his adult life. But about 20 years ago, some great people, just like yourselves today, got together and implemented and put aside some monies. He was able to go to an outpatient program. He attended it. And he has now been in recovery for all those years. Keep in mind that my father knows very little English. If he would have not attended such program, and if he was required to attend an English-speaking program, maybe I would not be here today. It was due to having a culturally specific program that my father understood the process of addiction. I now can do the same for the clients in need. Another thing is that last Friday, I had the privilege of going to a local gas station in Madras. And I say that I have a privilege because a lot of the times I don't have that privilege and somebody else needs to go because I'm busy at work or with my three children. It was surprising for me to see a former client of mine was now the manager of the local gas station. When he came to our treatment center, he was living on the streets. While in residential treatment, he got motivated to change. And he continued with outpatient and all the recommendations that were given to him. This is what an investment in culturally specific programs does. It repays your investment soon and many times over. It is a great privilege of being here with all of you today. And I thank you for letting me share my story. And I hope that we can all work together in providing the necessary services for this wonderful community. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pineda. Senator Gordon?
There's an African proverb that says, when the heart is full, it comes out through the mouth. And you've made our hearts very full with the stories about your lives this afternoon. And I recognize that we're in the presence of phenomenal women. And what I would like you to do is look at the women who are seated here, the men too.
Thank you.
And recognize that we're temporary. And we're going to need replacements. And also know that I believe the population now of the United States is over 50% women. Mm-hmm. And the legislative assembly should reflect that in all of our states.
Yes.
Yes. I'm just planting a seed here. and again, just thank you a thousand times for sharing from your hearts, and you bring forward such courage. Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say to Danielle, thank you for being such a clear case for why we need to fund our drug courts. And we shouldn't have anybody on a waiting list for the drug courts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Danielle, I hope that you keep your notes for the genesis of a book. Because I think you've been copious in keeping those notes, and I think that's good.
Madam Chair,
Senator Morissette.
To Olivia.
Yes.
What kind of funding do you have now for your residential treatment? I mean, do you have adequate funding? Are you losing your funding? Tell me about the condition of your...
We have inadequate funding.
Inadequate funding.
Yes. Okay. At this time, we have 13 beds, and just like we have heard great stories here, we have a waiting list. Keep in mind that Programa de Recuperación de Madres, now this is going to be in a test, okay, and it has to be...
Oh.
Not there! Programa de Recuperación de Madres, there's no breath in between. We are the only Spanish-speaking program in Central Oregon. And it is culturally specific. We have a great Mexican chef, and it's culturally specific for his descendant of Hispanic descent or Spanish speaking. Now I can't remember my words in English, but it is. And so we have a long waiting list. The need is there, and to find qualified Spanish speaking or bilingual clinician, it's a hard thing to do, just like Senator Gordon said. You know, I am going to be replaced one of these days. And one of the things is that I know it is important to keep our numbers, to keep our facts, but the effects that over 20 years ago, somebody got together and funded an outpatient program. My father attended the program. There's 8 of us. I was sharing with my director on the way up here is that my mom has 37 grandkids, 5 great grandkids. The ripple effect is tremendous. It cannot be measured. What would have happened if funding wouldn't have been given to that outpatient program that my father attended it? Maybe I would have gone back to Mexico. I don't know. Maybe I would have been another success story, just like we have heard before me. But that is the thing.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you, what's the source of your funding?
It is indigent funding.
More federal than
state. More, yes.
Oh, okay. Bob can address that later on now. Because this is a very important reason that we're here is to look at the funding aspect.
Most of the funding for residential care in this state has become Medicaid dependent.
Okay, Medicaid.
And the cuts that we took 3 years ago, 4 years ago, were in the state general fund area, and that makes it much more difficult to fund the kind of program that works in, and that the people from her culture tend to be less Medicaid eligible, so it makes it much more difficult to fund these kind of programs.
Okay.
Dr. Bates?
Oh, I'm curious because I can't control myself. Olivia, is there anything that's culturally appropriate for cowboys?
That is the reason why I said we're trying to implement it. We're getting a committee together. We'll have subcommittees that will go out in the community, research, and then we'll implement it. And I'll get back to you guys.
I like to hear that one. Thank you
for being with us today. Bob, why don't you say that while we call Hollis up with us. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, and maybe when Bob comes back up later, I'm curious how what strings we attach to the dollars that go down to the county level in terms of culturally specific treatment. I'm just curious if we have any.
You're asking very good questions.
I'm sorry, Bob. If we have any connections with money that goes down to the counties and any requirements around culturally specific, and we don't need to answer it now, but just something to think about.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we'll bring some information back.
Great, thank you.
Bob, do you mind taking an exit over and letting the other young man come over with him?
Thank you.
That's a little moral support that he wanted. Thank the three of you very much. Hollis?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Hollis Runner. I'm 17 years old, and I'm here today to speak about why treatment works. I'm in B.S. House Residential Drug and Alcohol Treatment Program in Corvallis, Oregon, on May 18, 2006, with not much desire to quit my drug and alcohol use. I had felt a sense of helplessness towards life and lacking sort of clear direction. While in treatment and clean and sober, I began to realize the serious impact my drug use had on my life, including damage with my relationships with family, problems in school, losing freedom, and not allowing me to live to my potential. My spending treatment was challenging. I had to learn new ways to cope with my depression and manage anger without the use of drug or alcohol. I was able to identify my signs of relapse warnings and develop a plan to prevent relapse. There are several reasons why my stay in treatment was so successful. A few of those reasons were my longer length of stay and quality of treatment. It took me time to learn the level of skills necessary to be successful at home and in the community, and an advantage a shorter stay would not have provided. It took time to first identify reasons why I used drugs and alcohol. I had trouble understanding why I felt the use of drugs was the only way to live life. However, during my stay in the Yes House, I began to feel that this way of living was no longer the way I wanted to live. After this realization, I felt as though I was in need of help. I learned how to express feelings I had about the way I was living and how severe my consequences were by the continuation of my drug and alcohol use. I learned how to express my emotions in healthy ways and that it is okay to do so. By doing so, I no longer had to hide my emotions or bottle them up. I realized that this was some of the reasons for my battle with depression and anger. During my stay at the S House, my mother lost her housing and means of paying rent due to her ongoing health problems. This was a challenging time for me in treatment because I was not only focused on my mother's health and lack of housing, but I lost her home as well. Since I had newly completed the residential program, my treatment plan was focused on where I would live upon discharge. One option I considered was living in an Oxford house. I chose the Oxford House of Corvallis and attended weekly meetings there with my sponsor while I still stayed at the S House. The Oxford House invited me and accepted me as a full-time member. When I had a place to stay, I was discharged from residential treatment and continued my treatment on an outpatient basis. I continued to work my job that I had obtained previously, realizing I would have to pay rent to live. This was a big step in my life because I had to learn the responsibilities of living on my own, planning a budget, paying the rent, and putting food on the table. After successfully completing residential treatment, continuing outpatient, and living on my own, I felt as though I need to help and support my mother in ways to live. I learned of a program in Corvallis called the Community Outreach that provides shelter and case management to a limited amount of people. I called and set up an appointment with the facility, and she was accepted. At this point of my outpatient treatment, I had more opportunities to develop my relationship with my mother. I continued to see her daily and bond with her in ways I never would have in my days of drug and alcohol use. The support of treatment, both residential and outpatient, throughout this entire time in my life was valuable in that it provided a way for me to deal with the challenges with life in the community through problem solving, good decision making, and building strong recovery support. I recently completed outpatient treatment and continue to attend 12-step support groups in the community. I'm also pleased to announce that this month I celebrated my 10-month clean and sober. I'm thankful for treatment community, particularly that of the counseling staff at the S House. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to talk about my own personal reason of why treatment works.
Hollis, thank you so much. Collins, I don't know whether you visited the Yes House in Corvallis. It's a wonderful place. My little grandson was there, and it's a wonderful place for young people. And I think now it's semi-private, but at the same time, it's really a good place. And the woman that runs it, at least when my grandson was there 2 years ago, It's really, really good, and it's a good program. So it's something, sometime you might want to stop by and see. Hollis, thank you, and don't look back. Keep looking forward.
Okay.
Comments from committee? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How old were you when you started working and paying rent?
17 or 16.
And would you mind commenting just very briefly for us on how your education has been impacted, school or studying?
I dropped out in ninth grade, my second week of school, and continued to use drugs, and after that, I soon got on probation, and continued to use for about a year or two after that, and I was sent to a school called Creekside in McMinnville, Oregon, and it's like a... It's a school where they put like a bunch of troublemakers together and they run together. So I continued doing school in there, and then after that I kept getting in trouble and still using, and I went to my first attempt of recovery was a failure, and I went back to my home, the society I went to, back and went using, and then my second attempt is still continuing. I don't plan to go back to high school. I plan to go to a community college and get my GED there. And
may I make a brief comment?
Please do.
I want to congratulate you on your success in the steps that you've taken already. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good question. Dr. Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, congratulations. Two things strike me here. When you go to get your GED in community college, I'm hoping you can enter a program we have that will pay for that for you. You've done enough already. Secondly, I was very impressed that you not only took responsibility for your own life, took responsibility for your mother's life, too, and got her into a program. Obviously, this has helped for her. Do you have any brothers or sisters? Where is your father?
My father's in the Middle East. That's where he he's not in the army or anything that happened to Easton, so he lives there. He's been there for the past 2 years. And I'm really from Washington, D.C., and I moved here about 2 years ago, and most of my family still live in Washington, D.C. My brother lives in Chicago.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This has been an amazing meeting, and I thank you so much for to all of you that came forward and told your stories. And I think that there isn't a person on this side of the dais that isn't just in amazement of the strength that you're showing and isn't really excited for the potential that you have for your futures. So please stay on the path that you're on and believe in yourselves, and you will do great things. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the panel that you brought before us today. And I want to thank the counselor from Yes House, who's just been just amazing. It's good to see you again, too. Thank you. Thank you for being here. And to Dr. Nicol for such a great panel that you put together today. And colleagues, it's just a reminder to all of us that many of these programs are doing great jobs. And sometimes when the science doesn't come in being as scientific as we want it, remember that when you're talking about human life, it's not just a number. It's somebody breathing on the other end there. And so the stories have been quite compelling today to see how lives are enriched, and in legislative terms, how many revenue sharers we have back in the system to help pay for the future of services that we need to continue doing in the state. So I want to thank you very much for that. Dr. Nicol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the members of my staff for helping to actually work out all the arrangements. I did very little of this. And I have to tell you that these are the kind of things that keep me going. I've been working in the field for almost 40 years. I never get tired of hearing these stories. And I'm continually moved by them. I wanted to just say, you know, talking about prevention, you saw in the College Dreams story, which was Josephine County Mental Health Program, and they do work in the schools, showing some of the protective factors where you hook kids up with positive role models, where you have expectations that you not use. And you begin to show kids, I mean, the basic idea there was to show kids what their lives could be like if they could stay in school and get off alcohol and drugs. They literally take kids around and show them nice houses and nice cars and say, would you like this for your life? And kids generally respond pretty positively to that. It's a nationally recognized program. And the originators of the program are Tom and Judy Drummond, and those are two names that you may never have heard of before, but they're incredible people, and there are many hundreds more like them around the state. I have to tell you that part of the frustration probably in the treatment and prevention community over the last number of years is we know how to do this stuff. This is not, you know, it's not rocket science. It's just good, solid things that we've learned through experience, and now more and more research shows that these are the kind of things that if we apply them consistently with a high degree of fidelity to what's been studied, we get these kind of results over and over and over again. So I need to just put in a plug for that kind of creativity that's come together here in Oregon. There are many other examples of such programs. And, you know, ultimately it's a real testament to the human spirit that people are somehow able to survive things that most of us can hardly imagine. So I want to thank the people who came up and told their stories today. It's really inspiring. Okay, hard acts to follow. I'm not even going to try because I have to go back to being a bit of a bureaucrat and walk you through the book. Let me go back to page 8 and just talk about the addictions and mental health has four, this is down at the bottom, has four primary program areas: alcohol and drug prevention, alcohol and drug treatment, and under alcohol and drug treatment, which we'll get to a little later, probably finish up on Monday on that, includes the gambling addiction treatment component. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then, of course, there's community mental health programs and the state hospitals, and we'll deal with those, I think, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week, if I understand the schedule. If you're interested in the Addictions and Mental Health Division, my office's structure, you can see that on page 9. I'm not going to walk you through it other than to make the comment that a number of the activities that we perform are things that are equally relevant for addictions and mental health. And because more and more people have both sets of disorders, it's valuable to have an office, in my opinion, that has a close connection between them. We still have somewhat of a separation between alcohol and drug specialists and mental health specialists, but there's a lot of good interaction. Housing is a perfect example of the kind of things that you heard about already today, where we have tremendous needs in both, and we've been able to take the technology that we've learned in mental health housing over about 12 to 15 years and really apply it more and more to the alcohol and drug area. So that's a critical piece of integration that I think the office has gotten pretty good at.
Madam Chair, can I just jump in? Please. Question. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Madam Chair. So is the siloing and the lack of sometimes integration between A and B mental health, that funding stream issue? Is it a structural issue? What can we do to fix that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think it's all of the above. The funding streams are pretty separate. The cultures have been pretty separate, although I frankly have done training around the country and in Canada on this issue. Both sets of diseases are chronic or long-term diseases, and if you really start thinking about the effective evidence-based technologies, they're really not that far apart. It's the continuing care model that's talked a lot about in medicine. And so I think there's actually not as much of a split as maybe traditionally we thought there had to be. I always like to point out that C.G. Jung and Bill W. have carried out an active correspondence. So, you know, it's one of the great names of, you know, psychology and one of the great names in peer recovery. We're talking to each other, and we need to reestablish that dialogue where it's not strong enough. There's probably always some degree of territoriality. I think that's inevitable in fields that have been funded and grew up somewhat separately. And I think that we're working on that. Many alcohol and drug programs are now finding it very useful to have mental health trained staff, and vice versa. On the mental health side, there are county mental health programs that are training practically all of their people in alcohol and drug technology and requiring, in some cases, CADC certification for mental health workers. So, I mean, when 70% of the acute psychiatric admissions are alcohol and drug involved, when 60 to 80% of my forensic patients have methamphetamine problems, you know, at the real level, there's not the need for the kind of separation that maybe we've traditionally had.
And I appreciate that answer. I would just say that the if you can provide for us, I think the territoriality and those other things break down when the money forces it to. So what do we do? What can we do differently around the money issue? And so that's probably a broader question than for today's discussion. But, you know, things change when we force people to change because we hold the purse strings. Yep. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, if I could just comment, I think when the money has been so scarce, it does increase the territoriality because everybody's trying to scrap for what they really feel that they need to have. To me, just quickly to say what I think one of the solutions to this is what I call braided funding. And I like to say let's braid, not raid funding. Mm-hmm. And there are always, many programs in this state are braiding alcohol and drug money and mental health money. We now have clarified you don't have to have separate treatment plans, you have to have separate evaluations. We ought to be able to make this look pretty seamless to the client who has both sets of problems. And that's where most programs are at this point, not that we don't have a ways to go.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Just a moment. Representative Garrard and then Senator Marsette and Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, in light of what happened in Klamath County a little while ago, in defunding our program based on a formula, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this formula and the fact that it can vary so much to our local providers around the state.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, we'll go into that in some detail a little bit later, but just let me say what we're talking about here is a segment of funding that comes to through the County Mental Health and Addictions Authority. It's called Service Element 66. It's what we call a continuum of care, and it's a flexible funding source for people who are not Medicaid eligible, and it can go for outpatient care, intensive outpatient care, and even into other kinds of things like detoxification. So it's a broad category. Historically, those funds got distributed in a variety of ways long before I was in the position that I'm in which sometimes programs competed successfully in a request for proposals in a competitive process, and some programs got money and other programs didn't get any money. Other times it's hard to explain exactly why there were differences. Some counties, though, have indeed ended up with much less per capita in that area and some with much more. A couple of years ago, this issue, in fact, last legislative session, the counties who are low in per capita funding in this category lobbied very hard and wanted something done to bring their dollars up. In the absence of new dollars, there's only one way to do that, and that is to take money from the counties that are higher per capita and give it to the lower per capita counties. That's what I would not want to do to have to solve this. But on the other hand, when I see such a disparity in per capita funding between one county and another, it's hard to say to the counties that are low, well, you just have to wait and wait and wait, and maybe someday we can fix the problem. So that's the dilemma that we've had. The governor's recommended budget, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, proposes funding so that we can bring all of the counties that are below the per capita average up to the per capita, statewide per capita average, and not have to take money away from those counties that are higher. Your county, Klamath, is one that's relatively richer, and when I say that, it's relatively richer. I don't think any county has the funds to do the job. And so your county also lost a detoxification program, which we've been trying hard to figure out a way to get that back. And I'm hopeful that at some point we can solve the equity problem so that we can have a better discussion about how to get your detoxification program back.
Thank you for your response.
Senator Morissette, and then Senator Bates.
Thank you. And then, Bob, I think we had those discussions in my committee last year about the inequity between various counties.
That's true. Senator Morissette, that's correct.
What I would like to hear a little bit, because we never, we talk a lot about funding, but we never talk about the cost shift. And I'm always interested in the estimates of what, of the cost shift. If the people that are, that we help have not been helped, where are they going to end up? What about the people who we can't help? Where are we going to have to pay for these people later on? So I think to put it in perspective, we have to have some idea of the cost shift just to balance it off, because the money that we're asking for is relatively small compared to the money that we have to put into the program after we don't do the treatment and prevention. We have to build the jails. We have to build the institutions. We have to pay for the broken homes. We have to put the kids in foster homes. We have to do all of these things. We don't have a choice. We do have a choice about not putting money in the front end, and we need to talk about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we can get those numbers for you. There have been quite a few studies done in Oregon and other places that show the cost offsets. But I think, you know, just to give you a couple of really quick examples, child welfare is a good example where if we don't treat parents who have methamphetamine problems, we'll see what we're seeing now, which is the caseload for child welfare continuing to trend up. And the pattern for Oregon, unfortunately, is we've made treatment less available. And, you know, whether scientifically you could absolutely prove the connection, I don't know, but I think it's, you know, common sense to think that's indeed what's happened in this state. There are also court costs, educational costs, and I think one of the things that I was really struck by with the panel just now was the intergenerational costs. Any one of these people who did not get treatment would have probably created additional people coming into this world who would have had the same sets of problems much of the time. And we tend to focus just on what's happening, you know, with the current generation, but I think it was very clear the intergenerational costs that are involved too.
Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kotick hit on, I think, a key issue here, and that's the siloing of these. But there's a bigger silo of that going on. This is a state that spends $17 billion a year in health care, primarily in physical health. But I would estimate that a great degree of that physical health is driven by mental health, drug and alcohol. People spending time in ICU because their diabetes isn't controlled because they haven't had their mental health drugs. People in detox, being detoxified from alcohol or drugs by physicians, another physical problem. And once that's done, they're put back out in the streets. Where we take our mental health patients and circle them back and forth through emergency rooms, and they'll take care of the needs. Until we truly reform the healthcare system, which we're trying to do in this session, these problems will not go away. The fact that an individual can be a dollar or two above what we fund in this state for the Oregon Health Plan and get no treatment is a continuing problem. If we have 100% access to physical health, mental health, drug and alcohol treatment, that problem goes away, and we start dealing with these problems on a rational basis, not the irrational problem we have right now. And it's been one of my drives for years that we stop thinking about physical health in one piece, mental health in one piece, drug and alcohol another. It's all the same person. If you don't treat the entire person, you never get the problem resolved.
Dr. Bates, that's interesting because I've written myself a note that says we should not divide mental health, drug, and alcohol any more than we should have been dividing the sciences of behavioral and physical health. We must fight that fight.
Madam Chair, just Senator Bates, thanks for the comment. We did a study a year or two ago and showed that people who actually got enrolled in both mental health and alcohol and drug programs in Oregon, and they're the lucky ones who got in, died at an average age in that one cohort of about 44 years old. So although we're spending a lot of money, we have a long ways to go. This is a population generally of people who have very severe health problems, and we're not catching on to them until they're often, you know, very, very ill, or unfortunately in some cases they die on us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow up on something that Senator Morris said, mentioned a couple minutes ago. We were getting into the topic of cost offsets. I think that we have failed to be more vigorous in analyzing cost offsets. We know whether it's from hard evidence or intuitively that money spent on the front end helps avoid costs somewhere else. I think there's a failure to act aggressively on rearranging what we fund or how we fund it for several reasons, and I'd like to speculate with my colleagues on two potential reasons. One is because some very hardworking people in many different kinds of agencies and programs, whether it's public programs or community-based, they do wonderful work, and if there were to be a disruption in funding, given that the pie is only this big, we want to spend more on this kind of service than that, it causes a disruption in jobs and in what kinds of programs start being funded at a greater level and which of them don't get increased funding, for example. So I think some of the discomfort, and it's hard for me to bring it up like this, but I think it's about jobs. It's not that we need fewer people providing help. We need many, many people providing health care, whether it's physical or mental health. We need many people providing services. It's not about the need to provide less. It's what we're providing and at what point in people's lives. But I think also we haven't been rigorous enough in following the costs. I think sometimes it's easy to think, well, yes, we know theoretically that we have cost offsets and we will avoid future costs, and we think it's pretty long term, 5 or 10 or 20 years out. But some of what we're hearing about now, we would recapture those cost offsets within the same biennium. We're talking about people who have to visit emergency rooms, people who lose housing and need other sorts of assistance, people who end up in the criminal justice system who shouldn't have been in the criminal justice system, in the same biennium that we could have been helping them with mental health treatment that's appropriate or housing that's appropriate. So I think we need to do much faster and closer work on even the near-term cost offsets, not something that makes us nervous to think about it because it's too theoretical and too far in the future. Thank you. Did you have closing remarks, Doctor?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that we is the committee going for another half an hour? Or what?
No, we're over at 2:30.
All right. Well, then I would say that we had a good discussion, and I look forward to next week.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Closing remarks, one of the members.
Madam Chair, I would just like to thank Bob Nickel for his participation this morning in the Mental Health Caucus, and for your continuing participation, and for delivering a report, the Community Services Work Group report for the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan, which is now available online for all members to read. Thank you.
Thank you.